Chapter 8. Believe Everything, Trust Nothing. When the telephone was still a novelty, it was physically wired into the home and perhaps placed in a nook built into the wall. Getting a second line was considered a status symbol. Similarly, public phone booths were built for privacy. Even banks of payphones in hotel lobbies were equipped with sound baffles between them to give the illusion of privacy. With mobile phones, that sense of privacy has fallen away entirely. It is common to walk down the street and hear people loudly sharing some personal drama, or worse, reciting their credit card number within earshot of all who pass by. In the midst of this culture of openness and sharing, we need to think carefully about the information we're volunteering to the world. Sometimes the world is listening. I'm just saying. Suppose you like to work at the cafe around the corner from your home, as I sometimes do. It has free Wi-Fi. That should be okay, right? I hate to break it to you, but no. Public Wi-Fi wasn't created with online banking or e-commerce in mind. It is merely convenient, and it's also incredibly insecure. Not all that insecurity is technical. Some of it begins, and I hope, ends with you. How can you tell if you are on public Wi-Fi? For one thing, you won't be asked to input a password to connect to the wireless access point. To demonstrate how visible you are on public Wi-Fi, researchers from the antivirus company F-Secure built their own access point, or hotspot. They conducted their experiment in two different locations in downtown London, a cafe and a public space. The results were eye-opening. In the first experiment, the researchers set up in a cafe in a busy part of London. When patrons considered the choices of available networks, the F-Secure hotspot came up as both strong and free. The researchers also included a banner that appeared on the user's browser stating the terms and conditions. Perhaps you've seen a banner like this at your local coffee shop, stipulating what you can and cannot do while using their service. In this experiment, however, terms for use of this free Wi-Fi required the surrender of the user's firstborn child or beloved pet. Six people consented to those terms and conditions. To be fair, most people don't take the time to read the fine print. They just want whatever is on the other end. Still, you should at least skim the terms and conditions. In this case, F-Secure said later that neither it nor its lawyers wanted anything to do with children or pets. The real issue is what can be seen by third parties while you're on public Wi-Fi. When you're at home, your wireless connection should be encrypted with WPA2. That means if anyone is snooping, he or she can't see what you're doing online. But when you're using open public Wi-Fi at a coffee shop or airport, that destination traffic is laid bare. Again, you might ask, what's the problem with all this? Well, first of all, you don't know who's on the other end of the connection. In this case, the F-Secure research team ethically destroyed the data they collected, but criminals probably would not. They'd sell your email address to companies that send you spam, either to get you to buy something or to infect your PC with malware, and they might even use the details in your unencrypted emails to craft spear phishing attacks. In the second experiment, the team set the hotspot on a balcony in close proximity to the Houses of Parliament, the headquarters of the Labour and Conservative parties, and the National Crime Agency. Within 30 minutes, a total of 250 people connected to the experimental free hotspot. Most of these were automatic connections made by whatever device was being used. In other words, the users didn't consciously choose the network, the device did that for them. A couple of issues here. Let's first look at how and why your mobile devices automatically join a Wi-Fi network. Your traditional PC and all your mobile devices remember your last few Wi-Fi connections, both public and private. This is good because it saves you the trouble of continually re-identifying a frequently used Wi-Fi access point, such as your home or office. This is also bad because if you walk into a brand new cafe, a place you've never been before, you might suddenly find that you have wireless connectivity there. Why is that bad? Because you might be connected to something other than the cafe's wireless network. Chances are your mobile device detected an access point that matches a profile already on your most recent connection list. You may sense something amiss about the convenience of automatically connecting to Wi-Fi in a place you've never been before, but you may also be in the middle of a first-person shooter game and don't want to think much beyond that. How does automatic Wi-Fi connection work? As I explained in the last chapter, maybe you have Comcast internet service at home, and if you do, you might also have a free, non-encrypted public SSID called Xfinity as part of your service plan. Your Wi-Fi-enabled device may have connected to it once in the past. But how do you know that the guy with the laptop at the corner table isn't broadcasting a spoofed wireless access point called Xfinity? Let's say you are connected to that shady guy in the corner and not to the cafe's wireless network. First, you will still be able to surf the net, so you can keep on playing your game. However, every packet of unencrypted data you send and receive over the internet will be visible to this shady character through his spoofed laptop wireless access point. If he's taken the trouble to set up a fake wireless access point, then he's probably capturing those packets with a free application such as Wireshark. I use this app in my work as a pen tester. It allows me to see the network activity that's going on around me. I can see the IP addresses of sites people are connecting to and how long they are visiting those sites. If the connection is not encrypted, it is legal to intercept the traffic because it is generally available to the public. For example, as an IT admin, I would want to know the activity on my network. Maybe the shady guy in the corner is just sniffing, seeing where you go and not influencing the traffic. Or maybe he is actively influencing your internet traffic. This would serve multiple purposes. Maybe he's redirecting your connection to a proxy that implants a JavaScript keylogger in your browser so when you visit Amazon, your keystrokes will be captured as you interact with the site. Maybe he gets paid to harvest your credentials, your username and password. Remember that your credit card may be associated with Amazon and other retailers. When delivering my keynote, I give a demonstration that shows how I can intercept a victim's username and password when accessing sites once he or she is connected to my spoofed access point. Because I'm sitting in the middle of the interaction between the victim and the website, I can inject JavaScript and cause fake Adobe updates to pop up on his or her screen, which, if installed, will infect the victim's computer with malware. The purpose is usually to trick you into installing the fake update to gain control of your computer. When the guy at the corner table is influencing the internet traffic, that's called a man-in-the-middle attack. The attacker is proxying your packets through to the real site, but intercepting or injecting data along the way. Knowing that you could unintentionally connect to a shady Wi-Fi access point, how can you prevent it? On a laptop, the device will go through the process of searching for a preferred wireless network and then connect to it. But some laptops and mobile devices automatically choose what network to join. This was designed to make the process of taking your mobile device from one location to another as painless as possible. But as I mentioned, there are downsides to this convenience. According to Apple, its various products will automatically connect to networks in this order of preference. 1. The private network the device most recently joined. 2. Another private network. And 3. A hotspot network. Laptops, fortunately, provide the means to delete obsolete Wi-Fi connections. For example, that hotel Wi-Fi you connected to last summer on a business trip. In a Windows laptop, you can uncheck the Connect Automatically field next to the network name before you connect, or head to Control Panel, Network and Sharing Center, and click on the network name. Click on Wireless Properties, then uncheck Connect Automatically when this network is in range. On a Mac, head to System Preferences, go to Network, highlight Wi-Fi on the left-hand panel, and click Advanced. Then uncheck Remember Networks This Computer is Joined. You can also individually remove networks by selecting the name and pressing the minus button underneath it. Android and iOS devices also have instructions for deleting previously used Wi-Fi connections. On an iPhone or iPod, go into your settings, select Wi-Fi, click the I icon next to the network name, and choose Forget This Network. On an Android phone, you can go into your settings, choose Wi-Fi, long press the network name, and select Forget Network. Seriously, if you really have something sensitive to do away from your house, then I recommend using the cellular connection on your mobile device instead of using the wireless network at the airport or coffee shop. You can also tether to your personal mobile device using USB, Bluetooth, or Wi-Fi. If you use Wi-Fi, then make sure you configure WPA2 security as mentioned earlier. The other option is to purchase a portable hotspot to use when traveling. Note, too, this won't make you invisible, but is a better alternative than using public Wi-Fi. But if you need to protect your privacy from the mobile operator, say to download a sensitive spreadsheet, then I suggest you use HTTPS Everywhere or a Secure File Transfer Protocol, SFTP. SFTP is supported using the Transmit app on Mac and the Tunnelier app on Windows. A virtual private network, VPN, is a secure tunnel that extends a private network from your home, office, or a VPN service provider to your device on a public network. You can search Google for VPN providers and purchase service for approximately $60 a year. The network you'll find at the local coffee shop or the airport or in other public places is not to be trusted. It's public. But by using a VPN, you can tunnel through the public network back to a private and secure network. Everything you do within the VPN is protected by encryption, as all your internet traffic is now secured over the public network. That's why it's important to use a VPN provider you can trust. It can see your internet traffic. When you use a VPN at the coffee shop, the sketchy guy in the corner can only see that you have connected to a VPN server and nothing else. Your activities and the sites you visit are all completely hidden behind tough-to-crack encryption. However, you will still touch the internet with an IP address that is traceable directly to you. In this case, the IP address from your home or office, so you're still not invisible even using a VPN. Don't forget, your VPN provider knows your originating IP address. Later, we'll discuss how to make this connection invisible. Many companies provide VPNs for their employees, allowing them to connect from a public network, i.e. the internet, to a private internal corporate network. But what about the rest of us? There are many commercial VPNs available, but how do you know whether to trust them? The underlying VPN technology, IPsec, Internet Protocol Security, automatically includes PFS, perfect forward secrecy. But not all services, even corporate ones, actually bother to configure it. OpenVPN, an open-source project, includes PFS. So you might infer that when a product says it uses OpenVPN, it also uses PFS, but this is not always the case. The product might not have OpenVPN configured properly. Make sure the service specifically includes PFS. One disadvantage is that VPNs are more expensive than proxies, and since commercial VPNs are shared, they can also be slow, or in some cases, you simply can't get an available VPN for your personal use, and you will have to wait until one becomes available. Another annoyance is that in some cases, Google will pop up a CAPTCHA request, which asks you to type in the characters you see on the screen before you can use its search engine because it wants to make sure you are a human and not a bot. Finally, if your particular VPN vendor keeps logs, read the privacy policy to make sure that the service doesn't retain your traffic or connection logs, even encrypted, and that it doesn't make the data easy to share with law enforcement. You can figure this out in the terms of service and privacy policy. If they can report activities to law enforcement, then they do log VPN connections. Another consideration with a VPN is its privacy policy. Whether you use a commercial VPN or a corporate-provided VPN, your traffic travels over its network, which is why it's important to use HTTPS so the VPN provider can't see the contents of your communications. If you work in an office, chances are your company provides a VPN so that you can work remotely. Within an app on your traditional PC, you type in your username and password, something you know. The app also contains an identifying certificate placed there by your IT department, something you already have. Or it may send you a text on your company-issued phone, also something you have. The app may employ all three techniques in what's known as a multi-factor authentication. Now, you can sit in a Starbucks or an airport lounge and conduct business as though you were using a private internet service. However, you should not conduct personal business, such as remote banking, unless the actual session is encrypted using the HTTPS Everywhere extension. The only way to trust a VPN provider is to be anonymous from the start. If you really want to be completely anonymous, never use an internet connection that could be linked to you, i.e., one originating from your home, office, friends' homes, a hotel room reserved in your name, or anything else connected to you. I was caught when the FBI traced a cell phone signal to my hideout in Raleigh, North Carolina back in the 1990s. So never access personal information using a burner device in the same location if you're attempting to avoid governmental authorities. Anything you do on the burner device has to be completely separate in order to remain invisible, meaning that no metadata from the device can be linked to your real identity. You can also install a VPN on your mobile device. Apple provides instructions for doing so, and you can find instructions for Android devices as well. If you've been following my advice in the book so far, you'll probably fare much better than the average Joe. Most of your internet usage will probably be safe from eavesdropping or manipulation by an attacker. So will your social media. Facebook uses HTTPS for all its sessions. Checking your email? Google has also switched over to HTTPS only. Most webmail services have followed, as have most major instant messaging services. Indeed, most major sites, Amazon, eBay, Dropbox, all now use HTTPS. To be invisible, it's always best to layer your privacy. Your risk of having your traffic viewed by others in a public network declines with each additional layer of security you employ. For example, from a public Wi-Fi network, access your paid VPN service, then access Tor with the HTTPS Everywhere extension installed by default in the Firefox browser. Then, whatever you do online will be encrypted and hard to trace. Say you just want to check the weather and not do anything financial or personal, and you are using your own personal laptop outside your home network. That should be secure, right? Once again, not really. There are a few precautions you still need to take. First, turn off Wi-Fi. Seriously. Many people leave Wi-Fi on their laptops turned on even when they don't need it. According to documents released by Edward Snowden, the Communications Security Establishment Canada, CSEC, can identify travelers passing through Canadian airports just by capturing their MAC addresses. These are readable by any computer that is searching for any probe request sent from wireless devices. Even if you don't connect, the MAC address can be captured. So if you don't need it, turn off your Wi-Fi. As we've seen, convenience often works against privacy and safety. So far, we've skirted around an important issue: your MAC address. This is unique to whatever device you are using, and it is not permanent. You can change it. Let me give you an example. In the second chapter, I told you about encrypting your email using PGP, pretty good privacy. But what if you don't want to go through the hassle, or what if the recipient doesn't have a public PGP key for you to use? There is another clandestine way to exchange messages via email. Use the drafts folder on a shared email account. This is how former CIA Director General David Petraeus exchanged information with his mistress, Paula Broadwell, his biographer. The scandal unfolded after Petraeus ended the relationship and noticed that someone had been sending threatening emails to a friend of his. When the FBI investigated, they found not only that the threats had come from Broadwell, but that she had also been leaving romantic messages for Petraeus. What's interesting is that the messages between Broadwell and Petraeus were not transmitted, but rather left in the drafts folder of the anonymous email account. In this scenario, the email does not pass through other servers in an attempt to reach the recipient. There are fewer opportunities for interceptions, and if someone does get access to the account later on, there will be no evidence if you delete the emails and empty the trash beforehand. Broadwell also logged into her anonymous email account using a dedicated computer. She did not contact the email site from her home IP address. That would have been too obvious. Instead, she went to various hotels to conduct her communications. Although Broadwell had taken considerable pains to hide, she still was not invisible. According to the New York Times, because the sender's account had been registered anonymously, investigators had to use forensic techniques, including a check of what other email accounts had been accessed from the same computer address, to identify who was writing the emails. Email providers such as Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft retain login records for more than a year, and these reveal the particular IP addresses a consumer is logged in from. For example, if you used a public Wi-Fi at Starbucks, the IP address would reveal the store's physical location. The United States currently permits law enforcement agencies to obtain these login records from the email providers with a mere subpoena. No judge required. That means the investigators had the physical location of each IP address that contacted that particular email account and could then match Broadwell's device's MAC address on the router's connection log at those locations. With the full authority of the FBI behind them, this was a big deal because Petraeus was the CIA director at the time, agents were able to search all the router log files for each hotel and see when Broadwell's MAC address showed up in hotel log files. Moreover, they were able to show that on the dates in question, Broadwell was a registered guest. The investigators did note that while she logged in to these email accounts, she never actually sent an email. When you connect to a wireless network, the MAC address on your computer is automatically recorded by the wireless networking equipment. Your MAC address is similar to a serial number assigned to your network card. To be invisible prior to connecting to any wireless network, you need to change your MAC address to one not associated with you. To stay invisible, the MAC address should be changed each time you connect to the wireless network, so your internet sessions cannot easily be correlated to you. It's also important not to access any of your personal online accounts during this process, as it can compromise your anonymity. Instructions for changing your MAC address vary with each operating system, i.e. Windows, macOS, Linux, or even Android and iOS. Each time you connect to a public or private network, you might want to remember to change your MAC address. After a reboot, the original MAC address returns. Let's say you don't own a laptop and have no choice but to use a public computer terminal, be it in a cafe, a library, or even a business center in a high-end hotel. What can you do to protect yourself? When I go camping, I observe the leave no trace rule. That is, the campsite should look just as it did when I first arrived. The same is true with public PC terminals. After you leave, no one should know you were there. This is especially true at trade shows. I was at the annual Consumer Electronics Show one year and saw a bank of public PCs set out so that attendees could check their email while walking the convention floor. I even saw this at the annual Security Conscious RSA conference in San Francisco. Having a row of generic terminals out in public is a bad idea for a number of reasons. One, these are leased computers, reused from event to event. They may be cleaned, the OS reinstalled, but then again, they might not be. Two, they tend to run admin rights, which means that the conference attendee can install any software he or she wants to. This includes malware, such as keyloggers, which can store your username and password information. In the security business, we speak of the principle of least privilege, which means that a machine grants a user only the minimum privileges he or she needs to get the job done. Logging into a public terminal with system admin privileges, which is the default position on some public terminals, violates the principle of least privilege and only increases the risk that you were using a device previously infected with malware. The only solution is to somehow be certain that you were using a guest account with limited privileges, which most people won't know how to do. In general, I recommend never trusting a public PC terminal. Assume the person who last used it installed malware, either consciously or unconsciously. If you log into Gmail on a public terminal, and there's a keylogger on that public terminal, some remote third party now has your username and password. If you log into your bank, forget it. Remember, you should enable 2FA on every site you access so an attacker armed with your username and password cannot impersonate you. Two-factor authentication will greatly mitigate the chances of your account being hacked if someone does gain knowledge of your username and password. The number of people who use public kiosks at computer-based conferences such as CES and RSA amazes me. Bottom line, if you're at a trade show, use your cellular-enabled phone or tablet, your personal hotspot, or wait until you get back to your room. If you have to use the internet away from your home or office, use your smartphone. If you absolutely have to use a public terminal, then do not by any means sign in to any personal account, even webmail. If you're looking for a restaurant, for example, access only those websites that do not require authentication, such as Yelp. If you use a public terminal on a semi-regular basis, then set up an email account to use only on public terminals and only forward email from your legitimate accounts to this throwaway address when you are on the road. Stop forwarding once you return home. This minimizes the information that is findable under that email address. Next, make sure the sites you access from the public terminal have HTTPS in the URL. If you don't see HTTPS, or if you do see it but suspect that someone has put it there to give you a false sense of security, then perhaps you should reconsider accessing sensitive information from this public terminal. Let's say you get a legitimate HTTPS URL. If you're on a login page, look for a box that says, "Keep me logged in." Uncheck that. The reason is clear. This is not your personal PC. It is shared by others. By keeping yourself logged in, you are creating a cookie on that machine. You don't want the next person at the terminal to see your email or be able to send email from your address, do you? As noted, don't log into financial or medical sites from a public terminal. If you do log into a site, whether Gmail or otherwise, make sure you log off when you are done and perhaps consider changing your password from your own computer or mobile device afterward just to be safe. You may not always log off from your accounts at home, but you must always do this when using someone else's computer. After you've sent your email or looked at whatever you wanted to look at and logged off, then try to erase the browser history so the next person can't see where you've been. Also, delete any cookies if you can, and make sure you didn't download personal files to the computer. If you do, then try to delete the file or files from the desktop or downloads folder when you're finished. Unfortunately, though, just deleting the file isn't enough. Next, you will need to empty the trash. That still doesn't fully remove the deleted stuff from the computer. I can retrieve the file after you leave if I want to. Thankfully, most people don't have the ability to do that, and usually deleting and emptying the trash will suffice. All these steps are necessary to be invisible on a public terminal. Chapter 9. You have no privacy? Get over it. At some point during the time that former antivirus software creator John McAfee spent as a fugitive from authorities in Belize, he started a blog. Take it from me, if you're trying to get off the grid and totally disappear, you don't want to start a blog. For one thing, you're bound to make a mistake. McAfee is a smart man. He made his fortune in the early days of Silicon Valley by pioneering antivirus research. Then he sold his company, sold all his assets in the United States, and for around 4 years, from 2008 to 2012, he lived in Belize, on a private estate off the coast. Toward the end of that period, the government of Belize had him under near-constant surveillance, raiding his property and accusing him of assembling a private army in addition to engaging in drug trafficking. McAfee denied doing either. He claimed he was fighting the drug lords on the island. He said, for example, that he had offered a flat-screen TV to a small-time marijuana dealer on the condition that the man stopped dealing. And he was known to pull over cars that he suspected were carrying drug dealers. McAfee, in fact, did have a drug lab, but not necessarily for recreational drugs. He claimed he was creating a new generation of helpful drugs. Hence his growing suspicion that cars full of white men outside his property were spies from pharmaceuticals companies such as GlaxoSmithKline. He further claimed that the raids by the local police were instigated by these same pharmaceuticals companies. Guarding his property were several men with guns and 11 dogs. A neighbor two houses to the south, Greg Fall, complained regularly to the authorities about the dogs barking late at night. Then, one night in November of 2012, some of McAfee's dogs were poisoned. And later that same week, Fall was shot, found face down in a pool of blood in his house. The Belize authorities naturally considered McAfee a person of interest in their investigation. As McAfee relates in his blog, when he heard from his housekeeper that the police wanted to talk to him, he went into hiding. He became a fugitive. But it wasn't the blog that ultimately led law enforcement to McAfee. It was a photo, and it wasn't even his own. A security researcher named Mark Lovelace, better known in security circles as Simple Nomad, noticed a picture of McAfee published on Twitter by Vice magazine in early December of 2012. The photo showed Vice's editor standing next to McAfee in a tropical location, maybe in Belize, maybe somewhere else. Lovelace knew that digital photos capture a lot of information about when, where, and how they are taken, and he wanted to see what digital information this photo might contain. Digital photos store what is known as exchangeable image file, or EXIF, data. This is photo metadata, and it contains mundane details such as the amount of color saturation in the image so that the photo can be accurately reproduced on a screen or by a printer. It can also, if the camera is equipped to do so, include the exact longitude and latitude of the place where the photo was taken. Apparently, the photo of McAfee with the Vice magazine editor was taken with an iPhone 4S camera. Some cell phones ship with geolocation automatically enabled. Lovelace got lucky. The image posted in the online file included the exact geolocation of John McAfee, who was, it turned out, in neighboring Guatemala. In a subsequent blog, McAfee said he faked the data, but that seems unlikely. Later, he said he intended to reveal his location. More likely, he got lazy. Long story short, the Guatemalan police detained McAfee and wouldn't let him leave the country. He then suffered a health condition, was hospitalized, and was eventually allowed to return to the United States. The murder of Greg Fall remains unsolved. McAfee now lives in Tennessee. And in 2015, he decided to run for president to advocate for more cyber-friendly policies in the U.S. government. He doesn't blog nearly as often nowadays. Let's say you are an ambitious young jihadist and you are proud to be posted to a recently established military headquarters of Daesh or ISIL. What's the first thing you do? You pull out your cell phone and take a selfie. Worse, in addition to the photo of you and your new digs, you post a few words about the sophisticated equipment available at this particular facility. Half a world away, reconnaissance airmen at Florida's Hurlburt Field are combing social media and see the photo. "We got an in," one of them says. Sure enough, a few hours later, three JDAMs, Joint Direct Attack Munitions, take out that shiny new military building, all because of a selfie. We don't always consider what else lies inside the frame of a selfie we've just taken. In film and theater, this is called the mise-en-scène, roughly translated from the French as what's in the scene. Your picture might show a crowded city skyline, including the Freedom Tower outside your apartment window, even a picture of you in a rural setting, maybe a prairie extending out to the flat horizon, gives me valuable information about where you live. These visuals provide tiny location clues that might tip off someone who is eager to find you. In the young jihadist's case, what was in the scene was a military headquarters. Embedded in the metadata of the selfie were the precise longitude and latitude, or geolocation, of the place where the photo was taken. General Hawk Carlisle, the head of the U.S. Air Combat Command, estimated it was a mere 24 hours from the time that selfie was first posted on social media to the complete destruction of that headquarters. Certainly the metadata inside your image files can be used to locate you. EXIF data in a digital image contains, among other things, the date and time when the picture was snapped, the make and model number of the camera, and, If you have geolocation activated on the device taking the photo, the longitude and latitude of the place where you took the image. It is this information within the file that the U.S. military used to find the Daesh headquarters in the desert, just as Mark Loveless used EXIF data to identify John McAfee's location. Anyone can use this tool. It's native in the file inspector on Apple OS X and in downloadable tools such as FOCA for Windows and MetaGoofil for Linux to gain access to the metadata stored in photos and documents. Sometimes it's not a photo, but an app that gives up your spot. In the summer of 2015, drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman escaped from a Mexican prison and immediately went off the grid. Or did he? 2 months after his escape from Mexico's maximum security Altiplano prison, El Chapo's 29-year-old son, Jesus Alfredo Guzman Salazar, posted an image to Twitter. Although the two men seated at a dinner table with Salazar are obscured by emoticons, the build of the man on the left bears a strong resemblance to El Chapo. Further, Salazar captioned the image, "August here, you already know with whom." The tweet also contains the Twitter location data, Costa Rica, suggesting that El Chapo's son failed to switch off the auto-tagging function on Twitter's smartphone app. Even if you don't have an escaped convict in your family, you need to be aware that the digital and visual information hidden, sometimes in plain sight, in your photos can reveal a lot to someone who does not know you, and it can come back to haunt you. Online photos can do more than just reveal your location. They can, in conjunction with certain software programs, reveal personal information about you. In 2011, Alessandro Acquisti, a researcher from Carnegie Mellon University, posed a simple hypothesis. "I wanted to see if it was possible to go from a face on the street to a social security number," he said. And he found it was indeed possible. By taking a simple webcam photograph of a student volunteer, Acquisti and his team had enough information to obtain personal information about that individual. Think about that. You could take a photo of a person out on the street and, using facial recognition software, attempt to identify that person. Without that person's confirmation of his or her identity, you may get a few false positives, but chances are a majority of the hits would reveal one name more than another. There's a blending of online and offline data, and your face is the conduit, the veritable link between these two worlds, Acquisti told ThreatPost. "I think the lesson is a rather gloomy one. We have to face the reality that our very notion of privacy is being eroded. You're no longer private in the street or in a crowd. The mashup of all these technologies challenges our biological expectation of privacy." For his study, Acquisti and others stopped students on the Carnegie Mellon campus and asked them to fill out an online survey. The webcam on the laptop took a picture of each student as he or she was taking the survey, and the picture was immediately cross-referenced online using facial recognition software. At the conclusion of each survey, several of the retrieved photos had already appeared on the screen. Acquisti said that 42% of the photos were positively identified and linked to the students' Facebook profiles. If you use Facebook, you are perhaps already aware of its limited facial recognition technology. Upload a photo to the site and Facebook will attempt to photo tag the people within your network, people with whom you are already friends. You do have some control over this. By going into your Facebook settings, you can require the site to notify you every time that happens and choose whether to be identified in the photo. You can also choose to post the photo to your wall or timeline only after you've been notified, if at all. To make tagged photos invisible in Facebook, open your account and go to Privacy Settings. There are various options, including limiting the images to your personal timeline. Other than that, Facebook has not yet provided an option to stop people from tagging you without permission. Companies such as Google and Apple also have facial recognition technology built into some of their applications, such as Google Photo and iPhoto. It may be worth looking at the configuration settings for those apps and services so that you can limit what facial recognition technology can do in each. Google has so far held back from including facial recognition technology in its image search feature, indicated by that little camera icon you see in the Google search window. You can upload an existing picture and Google will find the picture, but it will not attempt to find other photos showing the same person or people within the image. Google has, in various public statements, said that letting people identify strangers by face crosses the creepy line. Even so, some repressive governments have done just that. They have taken photos of protesters at large anti-government rallies and then put the images on the web. This is not using image recognition software so much as it is crowdsourcing the identification process. Also, some U.S. states have used their motor vehicle department's photo databases to identify suspects in criminal cases. But those are fancy state-based operations. What could a lone academic do? Acquisti and his fellow researchers wanted to see how much image-derived information about a person could be cross-referenced online. To find out, they used a facial recognition technology called Pittsburgh Pattern Recognition, or PitPat, now owned by Google. The algorithms used in PitPat have been licensed to various security companies and government institutions. Shortly after the acquisition, Google went on record about its intentions. As we've said for over a year, we won't add face recognition to Google unless we can figure out a strong privacy model for it. We haven't figured it out. Let's hope the company sticks to its word. At the time of this research, Acquisti was able to use PitPat paired with data-mined Facebook images from what he and his team considered to be searchable profiles, i.e., those on which the Carnegie Mellon volunteers had already posted photos of themselves along with certain pieces of personal information. They then applied this set of known faces to the anonymous faces on a popular online dating site. There, the researchers found that they could identify 15% of these supposedly anonymous digital heartbreakers. The creepiest experiment, however, involved linking a person's face to his or her social security number. To do that, Acquisti and his team looked for Facebook profiles that included the person's date and city of birth. Previously, in 2009, the same group of researchers had shown that this information by itself was enough to enable them to obtain a person's social security number. Social security numbers are issued sequentially per a state's own formula, and since 1989, SSNs have been issued on or very near the date of birth, making it even easier to guess a person's last four digits. After some initial calculations, the researchers then sent a follow-up survey to each of their CMU student volunteers, asking whether the first five digits of his or her social security number, as predicted by their algorithm, was correct, and a majority of them were. I'll bet there are some photos that you now don't want online. Chances are, you won't be able to take them all back, even if you could delete them from your social media site. That's in part because once you post something to a social network, it's owned by that network and out of your hands. And you agreed to this in the terms of service. If you use the popular Google Photos app, even deleting a photo there doesn't necessarily mean it's gone. Customers have found that images are still there even after they delete the app from their mobile devices. Why? Because once the image hits the cloud, it is app independent, meaning that other apps may have access to it and may continue to display the image you deleted. This has real-world consequences. Say you posted some stupid caption on a photo of someone who now works at the very company that you are applying to work for. Or you posted a photo of yourself with someone you don't want your current spouse to know about. Although it may be your personal social network account, it is the social network's data. You've probably never taken the trouble to read the terms of use for any website where you post your personal data, daily experiences, thoughts, opinions, stories, gripes, complaints, and so on. Or where you shop, play, learn, and interact, perhaps on a daily or even hourly basis. Most social networking sites require users to agree to terms and conditions before they use their services. Controversially, these terms often contain clauses permitting the sites to store data obtained from users and even share it with third parties. Facebook has attracted attention over the years for its data storage policies, including the fact that the site makes it difficult to delete an account, and Facebook isn't alone. Many websites have nearly identical language in their terms of use that would very likely scare you away if you had read the terms before signing on. Here's one example from Facebook as of January 30th, 2015. You own all of the content and information you post on Facebook, and you can control how it is shared through your privacy and application settings. In addition, 1. For content that is covered by intellectual property rights, like photos and videos, IP content, you specifically give us the following permission, subject to your privacy and application settings. You grant us a non-exclusive, transferable, sub-licensable, royalty-free, worldwide license to use any IP content that you post on or in connection with Facebook. IP license. This IP license ends when you delete your IP content or your account, unless your content has been shared with others and they have not deleted it. In other words, the social media company has the right to use anything you post to the site in any way it wants. It can even sell your picture, your opinions, your writings, or anything else you post, making money from your contribution without paying you a penny. It can use your posted comments, criticisms, opinions, libel, slander, if you're into that sort of thing, and the most personal details you've posted about your children, your boss, or your lover. And it doesn't have to do it anonymously. If you have used your real name, the site can use it too. All this means, among other things, that images you post to Facebook can end up on other sites. To find out whether there are any embarrassing photos of you out there in the world, you can perform what's called a reverse image search in Google. To do this, click on the tiny camera within the Google search window and upload any photo from your hard drive. In a few minutes, you will see any copies of that image findable online. In theory, if it's your photo, you should know all the sites that come up in the results. However, if you find that someone has posted your photo on a site you don't like, you have limited options. Reverse image searches are limited by what's already posted. In other words, if there is a similar image online but not the exact same image, Google won't find it. It will find cropped versions of the image you searched for, but in that case, the central data, or enough of it, remains the same. Once, for my birthday, someone tried to create a stamp with my image on it. The company, Stamps.com, has a strict policy against using images of convicted persons. My image was rejected. Perhaps they did an online image search. I was in a database somewhere as Kevin Mitnick, convicted of a crime. The following year, my friend tried an earlier photo under a different name, one taken before I was well known. She reasoned that perhaps this photo had not been uploaded online, and guess what? It worked. The second photo showing a much younger me was approved. This shows the limitations of image searches. That said, if you do find photos of yourself that you'd rather not see online, you have a few options. First, contact the site. Most sites have an abuse@nameofthesite.com email address. You might also contact the site's webmaster at admin@nameofthesite.com. Explain that you own the image and don't give permission for it to be posted. Most webmasters will take down the image without much fuss. However, if you need to, you can file a Digital Millennium Copyright Act or DMCA request by emailing dmca@nameofthesite.com. Be careful. Misrepresenting a DMCA request might get you into trouble, so seek legal advice if it gets to this level. If you still can't get the image removed, then consider going upstream and contacting the website's ISP, whether it's Comcast, GoDaddy, or another company. Most will take a legitimate DMCA request seriously. Besides photos, what else is in your social media profile? You wouldn't share everything there is to know about you with the person sitting next to you on the subway. In the same way, it's not a good idea to share too much personal information on impersonal websites. You never know who is looking at your profile. And once it's out there, you can't take it back. Think carefully about what you put in your profile. You don't have to fill in all the blanks, such as the university you attended or even when you attended. In fact, fill in the least amount of information you possibly can. You may also want to create a dedicated social media profile. Don't lie, just be deliberately vague with the facts. For example, if you grew up in Atlanta, say you grew up in the southeastern United States, or simply, I'm from the South. You may also want to create a security birthday, a day that is not your real birthday, to mask personal information even further. Be sure to keep track of your security birthdays, since they are sometimes used to verify your identity when you phone technical support or need to re-enter a site after you've been locked out. After creating or tweaking your online profiles, take a few minutes to look at the privacy options on each site. For example, within Facebook, you should enable privacy controls, including tag review. Disable suggest photos of me to friends. Disable friends can check me into places. Kids with Facebook accounts are perhaps the most worrisome. They tend to fill in every blank box they can, even their relationship status. Or they innocently reveal the names of the schools they attend and the teachers they have, as well as the numbers of the buses they ride each morning. While they don't necessarily tell the world specifically where they live, they might just as well. Parents need to friend their kids, monitor what they post, and ideally, discuss in advance what is acceptable and what is not. Being invisible doesn't mean you can't share updates about your personal life securely, but it involves both common sense and visiting and revisiting the privacy settings of the social media sites you use. Because privacy policies do change, and sometimes not for the better. Do not display your birthday, even your security birthday, or at the very least, hide it from the Facebook friends you do not personally know. Consider a post that says, Mrs. Sanchez is a great teacher. Another post might be about a crafts fair at Alamo Elementary. From Google, we can find that Mrs. Sanchez teaches the fifth grade at Alamo Elementary, and from this we can assume the student account holder is around 10 years old. Despite warnings from Consumer Reports and other organizations to those who do post personal information, people continue to tell all online. Remember that it is perfectly legal for third parties to come along and to take that information once it is out in public. Remember also that no one is compelling you to post personal information. You can post as much or as little as you want. In some cases, you are required to fill in some information. Beyond that, you decide how much sharing is right for you. You need to determine your own personal privacy level and understand that whatever information you provide cannot be taken back. To help you get on top of all the choices you have, Facebook launched a new privacy checkup tool in May of 2015. Despite tools like these, almost 13 million Facebook users back in 2012 told Consumer Reports magazine that they had never set or didn't know about Facebook's privacy tools. And 28% shared all or almost all their wall posts with an audience wider than just their friends. More tellingly, 25% of those interviewed by Consumer Reports said they falsified information in their profiles to protect their identity. And this figure was up from 10% in 2010. At least we're learning. While you do have the right to post information about yourself that isn't strictly accurate, be aware that in California, it is illegal to post online as someone else. You cannot impersonate another living individual. And Facebook has a policy that will not allow you to create an account under a false name. This actually happened to me. My account was suspended by Facebook because Facebook accused me of impersonating Kevin Mitnick. At the time, there were 12 Kevin Mitnicks on Facebook. The situation was fixed when CNET ran a story about the real Kevin Mitnick getting locked out of Facebook. There are, however, many reasons why individuals might need to post under a different name. If it is important to you, then find a social media service that allows you to post anonymously or under a different name. Such sites, however, will not match the breadth and reach of Facebook. Be careful whom you friend. If you have met the person face-to-face, fine. Or if the person is a friend of someone you know, maybe. But if you receive an unsolicited request, think carefully. While you can unfriend that person at any point, he or she will nonetheless have a chance to see your entire profile, and a few seconds is all it takes for someone with malicious intent to interfere with your life. The best recommendation is to limit all the personal information you share on Facebook, because there have been very personal attacks, even among friends, over social networking websites. And data visible to your friends can still be reposted by them elsewhere without your consent or control. I'll give you an example. A guy once wanted to hire me because he was the victim of extortion. He had met an amazing, beautiful girl on Facebook and began sending her nude photos of himself. This continued for a time. Then one day he was told to send this woman, who might have been some guy living in Nigeria using a woman's photo, $4,000. He did, but then contacted me after he was asked to send another $4,000 or his nude photos would be sent to all his friends, including his parents, on Facebook. He was desperate to fix this situation. I told him his only real option was to tell his family or to wait and see if the extortionist went through with the threat. I told him to stop paying the money. The extortionist wasn't going to quit as long as he continued to pay. Even legitimate social networks can be hacked. Someone could friend you just to get access to someone you know. A law enforcement officer could be seeking information on a person of interest who happens to be part of your social network. It happens. According to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, social networks have been used for passive surveillance by federal investigators for years. In 2011, the EFF released a 38-page training course for IRS employees obtained through the Freedom of Information Act that the foundation said was used for conducting investigations via social networks. Although federal agents can't legally pretend to be someone else, they can legally ask to be your friend. In doing so, they can see all your posts, depending on your privacy settings, as well as those of others in your network. The EFF continues to study the privacy issues associated with this new form of law enforcement surveillance. Sometimes corporations follow you, or at least monitor you, if you post or tweet something that they find objectionable, something as innocent as a comment about a test you took in school, for example. For one student, a tweet like that caused a lot of trouble. When Elizabeth C. Jewett, the superintendent of the Watchung Hills Regional High School in Warren, New Jersey, received a communication from the testing company that provided her school with a statewide exam, her reaction was surprise rather than concern. She was surprised that Pearson Education was watching a student's Twitter account in the first place. Minors are given a certain amount of privacy and leeway when it comes to what they post on social media, but students, whether they're in middle school, high school, or college, need to realize that what they are doing online is public and being watched. In this case, one of Jewett's students had allegedly tweeted material from a standardized test. In fact, the student had actually posted a question about a question, not a picture of the exam page, just a few words, on a one-day statewide test given in New Jersey, the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, or PARC, test. The tweet was posted around 3 o'clock p.m., well after students in the district had taken the test. After the superintendent spoke with a parent of the student who posted the tweet, the student removed it. There was no evidence of cheating. The tweet, not revealed to the public, was a subjective comment rather than a solicitation of an answer. But the revelation about Pearson unnerved people. The DOE, Department of Education, informed us that Pearson is monitoring all social media during PARC testing, Jewett wrote to her colleagues in an email that a local columnist made public without her permission. In that email, Jewett confirmed that at least three more cases had been identified by Pearson and passed along to the state DOE. While Pearson is not alone in monitoring social media in order to detect theft of intellectual property, its behavior does raise questions. How, for example, did the company know the identity of the student involved from his Twitter handle? In a statement provided to the New York Times, Pearson said, "A breach includes any time someone shares information about a test outside of the classroom, from casual conversations to posts on social media. Again, our goal is to ensure a fair test for all students. Every student deserves his or her chance to take the test on a level playing field." The Times said it confirmed through officials in Massachusetts, which is also administering the park test, that Pearson does cross-reference tweets about standardized tests with lists of students who have registered to take the tests. On this, Pearson declined to comment for The Times. For years, the state of California also monitored social media during its annual standardized testing and reporting STAR tests. In 2013, the last year the tests were given statewide, the California Department of Education identified 242 schools whose students posted on social media during administration of the tests, only 16 of which included postings of test questions or answers. The incident highlighted the degree to which students are under surveillance both within and outside of traditional school environments, said Ilana Zaidi, a privacy research fellow at New York University's Information Law Institute. Social media is generally seen as a separate domain from school. Twitter seems more like off-campus speech, so that Pearson's monitoring is more like spying on students' conversations in carpools than school hallways. However, she goes on to say, the conversation also needs to shift from focusing on individual interests and harms to take the broader consequences of information practices into account. Schools and vendors need to stop dismissing parents as Luddites simply because they can't articulate a specific and immediate harm to their child. Parents, in turn, need to understand that schools can't defer to all their privacy preferences because there are also collective interests at stake that affect the entire educational system. Twitter, with its iconic 140-character limit, has become pervasive, collecting a lot of seemingly tiny details about our daily lives. Its privacy policy acknowledges that it collects and retains personal information through its various websites, applications, SMS services, APIs, application programming interfaces, and other third parties. When people use Twitter's service, they consent to the collection, transfer, storage, manipulation, disclosure, and other uses of this information. In order to create a Twitter account, one must provide a name, username, password, and email address. Your email address cannot be used for more than one Twitter account. Another privacy issue on Twitter concerns leaked tweets, private tweets that have been made public. This occurs when friends of someone with a private account retweet or copy and paste that person's private tweet to a public account. Once public, it cannot be taken back. Personal information can still be dangerous to share over Twitter, especially if your tweets are public, the default. Avoid sharing addresses, phone numbers, credit card numbers, and social security numbers over Twitter. If you must share sensitive information, use the direct message feature to contact a specific individual. But be aware that even private or direct message tweets can become public. For today's youth, so-called Generation Z, Facebook and Twitter are already old. Generation Z's actions on their mobile devices center around WhatsApp, ironically now part of Facebook, Snapchat, not Facebook, Instagram and Instagram Stories, also Facebook, and Vine, now part of Twitter. All these apps are visual in that they allow you to post photos and videos, or primarily feature photos or videos taken by others. Instagram, a photo and video sharing app, is Facebook for a younger audience. It allows follows, likes, and chats between members. Vine is a short video app that has given rise to its own art form, the 6-second video. Both Instagram and Vine have terms of service and appear to be responsive to takedown requests by members and copyright holders. Snapchat, perhaps because it is not owned by Facebook, is perhaps the creepiest of the bunch. Snapchat advertises that it allows you to send a self-destructing photo to someone. The life of the image is short, about 2 seconds, just long enough for the recipient to see the image. Unfortunately, 2 seconds is long enough for someone to grab a quick screenshot that lasts. In the winter of 2013, two underage high school girls in New Jersey snapped photos of themselves, naked, and sent them to a boy at their school over Snapchat, naturally assuming that the images would be automatically deleted 2 seconds after they sent them. At least that's what the company said would happen. However, the boy knew how to take a screenshot of the Snapchat message and later uploaded the images to his Instagram app. Instagram does not delete photos after 2 seconds. Needless to say, the images of the naked underage girls went viral, and the school superintendent had to send a note home to the parents asking that the images be deleted from all students' phones, or they would risk being arrested on child pornography charges. As for the 3 students, as minors, they couldn't be charged with a crime, but each was subjected to disciplinary action within the school districts. And it's not just girls sending nude photos to boys. In the United Kingdom, a 14-year-old boy sent a naked picture of himself to a girl at his school via Snapchat, again, thinking the image would disappear after a few seconds. The girl, however, took a screenshot, and you know the rest of the story. According to the BBC, the boy and the girl will be listed in a UK database for sex crimes, even though they are too young to be prosecuted. Like WhatsApp, with its inconsistent image blurring capabilities, Snapchat, despite the app's promises, does not really delete images. In fact, Snapchat agreed in 2014 to a Federal Trade Commission settlement over charges that the company had deceived users about the disappearing nature of its messages, which the federal agency alleged could be saved or retrieved at a later time. Snapchat's privacy policy also says that it does not ask for, track, or access any location-specific information from your device at any time, but the FTC found those claims to be false as well. It is a requirement of all online services that individuals be 13 years of age or older to subscribe. That is why these services ask for your birth date. A user could, however, just say, under penalty of perjury, "I swear that I am over the age of 13, or 21, or whatever." Parents who find that their 10-year-olds have signed up for Snapchat or Facebook can report them and have those accounts removed. On the other hand, parents who want their kids to have an account often alter the child's birth date. That data becomes part of the child's profile. Suddenly, your 10-year-old is 14, which means that he or she might be getting online ads targeted at older children. Also note that every email address and photo your child shares over the service is recorded. The Snapchat app also transmits Wi-Fi-based and cellular-based location information from Android users' mobile devices to its analytics tracking service provider. If you're an iOS user and enter your phone number to find friends, Snapchat collects the names and phone numbers of all the contacts in your mobile device's address book without your notice or consent, although iOS will prompt for permission the first time it is requested. My recommendation is to try another app if you want true privacy. In North Carolina, a high school student and his girlfriend were charged with possessing naked photos of minors, even though the photos were of themselves and had been taken and shared consensually. The girlfriend faced 2 charges of sexual exploitation of a minor, one for taking the photo and another for possessing it. Sexting aside, that means it is illegal for North Carolina teens to take or possess nude photos of themselves. In the police warrant, the girlfriend is listed as both victim and criminal. The boyfriend faced 5 charges, 2 for each photo he took of himself, plus 1 for possessing a photo of his girlfriend. If convicted, he could face up to 10 years in prison and have to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life, all for taking naked photos of himself and keeping one that his girlfriend sent him. When I was in high school, I simply met someone and asked her out. Today, you have to put some information online so people can check you out first, but be careful. If you are using a dating site and access it from someone else's computer, or should you happen to use a public computer to access it, always log out. Seriously, you don't want someone to hit the back button on the browser and see your dating information, or change it. Also, remember to uncheck the box that says "Remember Me" on the login screen. You don't want this or any other computer to automatically log someone else into your dating account. Say you go on a first date, maybe a second date. People don't always reveal their true selves on a first or second date. Once your date has friended you on Facebook or followed you on Twitter or on any other social network, he or she can see all your friends, your pictures, your interests. Things can get weird fast. We've covered online services. What about mobile apps? Dating apps can report your location, and part of that is by design. Say you see someone you like in your area. You can use the app to find out if that person is nearby. The mobile dating app Grindr gives very precise location information for its subscribers. Perhaps too precise. Researchers Colby Moore and Patrick Wardle from the cybersecurity firm Synac were able to spoof requests to Grindr in order to follow some of the people in its service as they moved about a single city. They also found that if they had three accounts search for one individual, they could triangulate the results to get a much more precise measurement of where that person was at any given moment. Maybe dating apps aren't your thing, but even logging into the Yelp service to search for a good restaurant gives third-party businesses information about your sex, age, and location. A default setting within the app allows it to send information back to the restaurant, telling it, for example, that a woman, age 31, from New York City, was looking at its review. You can, however, go into your settings and choose Basics, which reveals only your city. Unfortunately, you cannot disable the feature entirely. Perhaps the best way to avoid this is to not log in and simply use Yelp as a guest. Regarding geolocation, it is a good idea in general to check if any mobile apps you use broadcast your location. In most cases, you can turn this feature off, either in each individual app or entirely. And before agreeing to download any Android app, always read the permissions first. You can view these permissions in Google Play by going to the app, then scrolling down to the section above Google Play content that says Permissions. If the permissions make you feel uncomfortable, or if you think they give the app developer too much control, then do not download the app. Apple does not provide similar information about the apps in its store, and instead, permissions are prompted as they are needed when using the app. In fact, I prefer to use iOS devices because the operating system always prompts before disclosing private information, like my location data. Also, iOS is much more secure than Android if you don't jailbreak your iPhone or iPad. Of course, well-funded adversaries could purchase exploits for any operating system in the marketplace, but iOS exploits are quite expensive, costing over $1 million.